Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the 34th Annual Friends of Old Time Radio Convention. Before we start, I want to introduce the panel so you know who everybody is. No? You don't want to do it that way? Oh, okay. We're going to surprise you. You can't know.
Good start,
we can't tell you who anybody is. Okay. For our first guest, Brian's going to introduce that.
Hi, everybody. We have just an incredible panel today. And one of the people that we're going to introduce here is the person that that I had known since I was probably 13 years old. Maybe a lot of you have as well.
Joe Franklin?
No, he's gone. Oh, okay. He's gone already. This guy is one of the greats in the popular music area because he is the one that introduced some of the greatest acts in popular music to us in the 50s and 60s. And I don't know why he left, because he did the greatest stuff in the world. And I'm going to show you a little clip to start it off so you get an idea of how gigantic this guy was doing this kind of work in the business. So here it is. Here's a little clip to see if you recognize who we're talking about.
So, man, let your eyeballs bug, man. Because here comes the twist. Play cold.
Oh, no. Let's twist. If the thing's gonna be all right, turn to your left, senior. Turn to your right. Then I'm gonna tell you all right. Everything's gonna be all right. Turn to the left, turn to the right. I'm gonna be near on that.
Ladies and gentlemen, the great Clay Cole, right here. Now you know how he stays so skinny.
By the way, I got the notification from our engineering department to turn down the music. Didn't we get that?
That was a familiar tone. Yes. Turn down the music.
I thought my father created that expression.
Yeah, mine too. Well, your past comes back to haunt you.
I want to know if you can do that now.
Oh, good Lord, no. Oh, yeah. I can't even stand up. Are you kidding? I don't know where I got some of those answers. I can't believe it. I think back then the doctor gave me a whole shitload of diet pills to take these. And from then on, I was freaking out. That's all I remember. You got more surprised.
No,
anyway, that was from just around the clock. Actually, 1960-61 was the most incredible years of my life because when I started on Channel 13, somebody asked me to do if I would like to make a record. Everybody in the world would like to make one record. So Teddy Van produced and wrote a song called Here, There, Everywhere. So I had a record. Then secondly, Sid Bernstein asked me if I would do a Christmas show at the Brooklyn Paramount Theater that would take over when Alan Freed was suddenly whisked from the air. So I got to do a 10-day Christmas show at the Brooklyn Paramount, the second largest theater in New York, with 4,500 seats. And we had on the show Ray Charles, Bobby Rydell, Brenda Lee, Dion, Neil Sedaka, Johnny Burnett, Bobby V, Jimmy Charles, Little Anthony the Imperials, the Drifters, the Shirelles, the Coasters, Dante and the Evergreens, and the band leader was an unknown 19-year-old trumpet player named Bobby Vinton. And we broke the all-time box office record at the Brooklyn Paramount, which still stands to this very day. Then the third thing that happened is that I got a call in the middle of the show. We're doing our show live on Saturday night. The stage manager comes up to me and says, call your agent immediately after the show. It's very important. I didn't figure out what that could be. So we did the show live, and I raced into my dressing room, called my agent. She said, you better sit down. How would you like to go to Hollywood and make a movie? I said, you're kidding. What happened was Sam Katzman, the producer, was in town. He was in his suite at the Sherry Netherlands, and he saw my show. And he said, oh, that guy would be great. So he called Joyce Selznick, who was the talent coordinator of Columbia Pictures, and said, who's that guy on TV? And she knew it was me, and she called my agent at William Morris. We were all chatting and making the deal over the phone while I was on the air. And she said, you're leaving in 2 weeks. You're going to Hollywood, make a picture for Columbia Pictures with Dion, Chubby Checker, Vicki Spencer, the Marcells. And three amazing things happened in 1 year. The records, the stage show, and the movie. I could have quit right then. I mean, that was my dream. I was living my dream.
So, did you run reruns during that time so that you could go ahead and...
No, the station, Channel 13, was actually very gracious to me. They had someone else fill in for me while
who was your guest host?
I have no idea.
Ah.
I honestly don't remember. I can't remember everything. And besides, I was away.
By the way, we should mention that he has one of the best books out on popular music and rock and roll in his era. Everything that he has done during that period of time is called Shaboom, right over there. He's autographing books here at the convention. I was so thrilled to be able to get him to come to this convention because I've admired him for years and years and years. Who's standing up? Oh, hold up the book. They want you to hold up the book.
By the way, this conference lasts until 4:12, which happens to be my room number, and my brothers are there waiting to sell you the book.
That's right.
4:12.
Now, I have another surprise for you. As a 13-year-old, I used to watch your show all the time, 12, 13 years old, and I had a little 8-millimeter camera, and I filmed off the TV, the Clay Cole show. Now, I only have a tiny little bit to show you here, but I made you a copy of this so that you can have at least something, because it seems to be that all the shows are gone. They're all been erased, except maybe this snippet that I've got here. But what I decided to do with this little clip that I have is, have you guessed who the rock and roll guests are that you have on in these clips, in this little section here? So we need you to talk into your microphone. As soon as you see the person, we'll figure out how many points you earn for every... and make
them, the stars.
Maybe we'll sell you a book of Shaboom in return. But I'm going to play it for you, and at the very end, you're interviewing somebody there who is another icon in the world of media, in radio, I would say radio, TV also. No longer with us, but this is a little clip here. So see if you can tell us who the first guests are on this show.
Okay.
Let's see who it is. Who's that?
It's three. Looks like Joey D.
No.
Guys. Three guys, Delville.
No. Close.
Delville, Danny and the Juniors.
Close.
Danny and not the Juniors. The Detergents.
Ron Dante and the Detergents.
Leader of the Laundromat.
Okay.
Now the next one. Okay, after this, who's this next one playing guitar? Now,
Del Shannon.
Johnny Rivers.
Johnny Rivers.
Johnny Rivers,
Johnny Rivers. And then the next one, you're going to see.
Unbelievable.
Who the next one is on your show.
Yeah, who's that?
On your show a lot, I think. England.
Adam Faith.
That's Adam Faith.
Don't even remember him being on my show.
And the next clip is of you interviewing a guest who's talking about being the fifth Beatle.
Oh, that has to be Murray the K.
That's right. So you're going to see a little bit. It's Paul McCartney, right? And Ringo. And then the last thing is... the Clay Cole show.
Oh, my Lord, look at that.
There's Murray Kaufman, right?
Yeah.
That's it.
Well, that was fun. There's no other... You got it. Thanks for you. That's so cool. How did I do? two out of three ain't bad.
You win half your book.
But here, I didn't see it.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
How cool is this?
Thanks, Brian.
That's okay. Tell us what happened, though, basically, after. I mean, you were just an icon to the kids and everything, and we all watched you every single day. And what year did the show go off?
Well, it never went off. In 1968, I was 30 years old, and we had just gone through the British invasion, and the show had gone through the roof in the ratings. It was really one of the hottest shows in New York television because of the guests. I mean, we had an incredible lineup of guests. And all of a sudden, the actors started to come through, but students couldn't relate to it. They were, you know, stoned out druggies and acid rock psychedelic singers with heavy metal overtones. And I couldn't relate to them. The only group I could really relate to was Love and Spoonful, but they were New Yorkers, you know, Greenwich Village kids, and they had a great sense of humor. And I loved them. But the shift in popular music from what I was used to, I always said I wanted to be a song and dance man. Is what I really wanted to be. I wanted to be a Broadway, you know, singer, actor, dancer. But I got sidetracked into rock and roll. But then I really loved it because I loved to dance. And I started in 1953 on a TV show in Ohio when I was 15, producing and hosting a Saturday night pop music show. But we were playing Eddie Fisher, Patti Smith, The Horror, Aces, Four Lads, McGuire Sisters. All of a sudden I'm playing Everly Brothers, Fats Domino, Dwayne Eddy, and all of a sudden I found myself doing a rock and roll show. But I liked it. I loved the dance, so perfect dance music, and my career shifted. I became a rock and roll, not disc jockey, personality on the air that plays records. See, I could never be a disc jockey because a disc jockey is a guy who sits alone in a room with a stack of records and a bunch of jingles and has to have absolutely perfect pitch as far as delivering commercials. They have to multitask on intros and outros. I mean, their job is something I couldn't do. So I never claimed to be a disc jockey because what they do is so special that I could never do it. But and on TV, I was the guy that played records right through the beginning of rock and roll in 53, right through the British invasion. But when the psychedelic rock and acid rock stuff, and I was 30, and the mantra at that time was never trust anyone over 30, I thought, well, it's time to hang it up and let some young person take over. So I wasn't deserting a sinking ship because we were still had a high rating, but I thought it was time to leave, and so I just quietly said goodbye and walked away. Right, Dennis? He was there through it all.
But how can you just, you left, and then nobody really heard of you or saw you after that? What did you do? I mean, you just
well, it was sort of on purpose. I felt when I walked away from it, I just wanted to let it be. You know,
what would you do with your time, though? You mean, you were so busy during that time.
I worked behind the scenes. When I was a kid, in the early days of television, the host was always the guy that produced the show. He had the power. Lately, television has shifted from the host to the producer. The host now does what the producer does. But in the old days, even when we did our shows, I was in charge. I got the big blank piece of yellow paper and filled in, okay, Gene Kitt, we'll open the show, then we'll have Tracy, and then a break. And so I was really producing the show, and I loved that part of it. So for the next 40 years, I was a producer, writer, and director of television. I did over 3,500 broadcast television shows and one. Well, I won two personal Emmys, but my company won four altogether.
What shows did you do?
The Oscar winners, I mean, the Emmy winners were Oscar shows I did with Joel Siegel.
Oh, really?
With local is that program.
Here in New York?
It was all over the country.
Oh.
Before the Oscars. But I did a show about Marilyn Monroe with Jane Russell and Robert Mitchum, and we reunited them with Jim Doherty, her very first husband. And they were all friends before they were all famous, so that was a really cool show. I did a show on Stan Musial, the great St. Louis Cardinal legend. I did a show with Omar Sharif, you know, the world champion bridge player. Fun. So I, you know, had a lot of fun. My very last job, when I had moved to North Carolina, I did the San Remo Music Festival in Italy. I got to spend 4 months in Italy, and the show was all pop divas of the 2002. We had Britney Spears, Destiny's Child, Alicia Keys, Shakira, Anastasia, all the pop divas from all over the world, one from Germany, Mexico, that we wouldn't know here.
So you never really retired. You really kept going.
I made up my mind I was not going to be one of those guys who was on every PBS pledge break or every telethon or every store opening, and whether there's a camera, I wasn't going to be the guy who was always in there. I just, you know, I wanted to back off and just let it be. And, it worked because I can now eat a Luigi dinner without it getting chilled because, you know, people are always in the restaurant getting autographs on the piece of paper and the napkin. And, you know, I lived a quieter life, which suited me fine because I'm really a quiet, basic, private person.
When did you move from New York? Was it to New York to North Carolina?
Yeah, in 2001, actually. I moved there September 1st, and, of course, 10 days later, the towers fell, which was very, very, very...
Were you always in Manhattan?
Yeah, I always lived in Manhattan 43 years.
It's unbelievable because we all think of you as like, you know, what happened to Clay Cole, but you actually were very busy doing things right up until 2000.
Yeah, but quietly behind the scenes. This funny thing, when I first got my computer, I think everybody does with every star anywhere or anybody in the business, they Google themselves, you know. So I Googled Clay Cole to see what was going on out there. And I came across a blog. And somebody had asked the question, whatever happened to Clay Cole? And somebody named Dave wrote with great confidence, oh, I heard Clay Cole died 10 years ago. Hello? I said, you know, maybe this is time for me to write a book. Now, through the years, even when I was 25 years old, an agent came to me and said, you should write a book. Well, I don't know how it's going to end. Why write a book when you're 25? I thought that was ridiculous. And through the years, people would approach me, you know, do a book about your life. I said, well, I was only known in New York City. What do they care about me in Chicago or Omaha? There'd be no interest. But as I began to write the book, I realized my story is the story of rock and roll. Because I was there as a teenager, hearing it, and on the air playing it. And it follows from the very, very, very beginning. It was with Shaboom, the first rock and roll song I ever heard, Church Bells May Ring, with Angel, all those great, great early right through the folk music, the protest music thing, the girl group era, right through the British invasion, and then, of course, psychedelic rock. So I was basically there from the beginning through the... And that period fascinates people.
Mm-hmm. And I must tell you all, it is really well written, and written only by Clay Cole. He did not have any help in writing this book, so it's really...
I live alone.
All right, but... Clay, a couple of weeks ago, we talked on my radio show, and you were discussing who, I asked you who didn't appear on your show, and you said it's probably easier to figure who didn't than did, because everybody I speak to, oh, I was on Clay's show, or I danced on Clay's show, or I used the bathroom on Clay, but I was there.
Yes.
You threw two names at me. Elvis was not on your show,
Elvis and the Everly Brothers.
And the Beach Boys, you said you really didn't care about.
Well, you know, the Beach Boys didn't travel east. Even in those days. But even if they had, see, I have a theory that the Beach Boys were not among the favorites of New York teenagers. They were more in tune to the gritty working man music of Frankie Valli or Dion and the Belmonts. That's New York music. If a kid in the Bronx wants to go surfing? Hello? Well,
that's why they had New York's a Lonely Town when you're the only surfer boy around. Well, remember that record?
To drive a little Ducey coupe and all that, I mean, a Woody in the Bronx had a whole different meaning, if you know what I mean. So the Beach Boys were not, you know, among our playlists. We played, here's a perfect example of how our show, forgive me, but this is going to be the Clay Cole show today, I guess. When people use shorthand to describe my show, they say, a Clay Cole show, well, it was like Dick Clark's American Bandstand. Well, that's the shorthand version. It was nothing like Dick Clark's American Bandstand. We were a very hip show. We had the only rock and roll show I ever know that had comics on every week. We had Richard Pryor when he was unknown, and what's his name? The guy that just died? George Carlin. Yeah, he did the Hippie Kitchen Whaler Man. He did a sketch where he played the disc jockey, but he sang all the songs, sang all the jingles, did all the weather, and he was hysterical. Fanny Flagg, I mean, we had every week a different comic. Soupy did it, Jerry Lewis did it, Steve Allen did it. So my real interest was of the young, up-and-coming comics, giving them a break on the show. So our show was really much different than any of those other shows around the country. There's a song that Dion and the Belmonts made that brings home my point. They had a two-sided record. On one side was Where or When, the Rodgers and Hart song that was written back in the 30s. And on the flip side was That's My Desire, you know, the Frankie Lane signature song. Now, the whole country, disc jockeys all from coast to coast, were playing Where or When. It's perfectly fine. But if you flip it over, that's New York doo-wop, That's My Desire. And we pounded away on that one every single day, and it became an East Coast hit. So I said, if you want to know the difference between what the rest of the country was and how New York was sharp and hit, just listen to those two records, and you'll get it right away.
Clay, do you remember a young lady who was a regular on your show? Her name was Tracy Day.
And there she is.
Here comes the boy that I love. Here comes the boy that I...
Tracy, how did you wind up on his show?
Well, the record I think was out at the time, Bob Seger. He also was the producer for Four Seasons, and John DeLone, I think I just looked at you.
We put together a Wednesday show. The station was happy with the Saturday rating, so they gave us another hour on Wednesday, but they wanted a whole different format. So I invited Tracy and Adele Satin and a guy named Brian McKeown, who was replaced by Benny Thomas, by the way, and Angela Martin, who was very popular on the Milton Berle show and Ed Sullivan show when she was a child as a ventriloquist. And she was very pretty, and she was the other girl singer on the show. And Tracy, the Del Satins, and Angela and Benny, we did a Wednesday night show for a couple of years. And I also remember, most people don't know this, Tracy co-hosted a bandstand-type show in Philadelphia with the legendary Ed Hurst. Yes.
You want to tell us about that?
Yeah, I think somebody saw me somewhere. Maybe I was doing promoting my record or whatever, and had a chance to talk.
Which record?
Get along with Ashley now? Whatever. And they said, wow, you can talk. You know, I said, fine. And they said, would you come out to Atlantic City? We're going to do a show from the Steel here. Ed Hurst, which is moderator, and all the famous people that come out to the field here, like Louis Armstrong, will be on the show, and will be my co-host. Good. I should have considered that thing. It could have been another Barbara Walters or something. I don't know what happened. But so I went out there for the whole summer, and it was great people, and that was it. The field here was okay.
Who discovered you?
Well, I recorded a demo record, and I think Doc Thomas. You know Doc Thomas? Morty Schulman? Yeah. And it was a demo, and remember the Brill Building where everybody went and aspired to be like a star? And my mother, who was born in Italy, but loved it that I could sing, she said, well, you know what? You need to make a demo record. So that's what I did. And somehow somebody told her about this place.
How did Doc Thomas come into it?
No, it was just a demonstration record that I did that you must have heard somewhere, I don't know where, and he called me in and he wanted to talk to me, which he did, and then somehow nothing materialized. I didn't report to Doc Thomas, but Bob Crew heard the demo, and he said, you know, you're good, and come over to my place, so to speak, okay, and I did, the first record I did for Bob Crew was the cover record of Sherry from the Four Seasons called Jerry, I'm Your Sherry. And I have to say, he was a marketing genius, Bob Crew, because he said, you know, you're an unknown artist, but Sherry is a big hit, and you're going to be the answer record, and I can guarantee you that this jockeys will play the record, and they did, all over New York. There I was. They were familiar with me. The record wasn't a hit, but the next record and a few after that got a real big amount of play, and especially going to get along with that now.
You know, one of the problems was that most answer songs didn't make a lot of money.
Right. I never made any money. Yeah.
Watch him walk.
Wrong number. Wrong number. 17.
Here we go.
And the Martin Block Show continues now in the Make Believe Ballroom.
Now don't stop singing. You gotta get on.
That's one of the first times I think I heard your voice on that one. Now, Bob Cruise said to you that your real Italian name was not good enough, or you didn't like it?
Yes, at that time, Liza Minnelli kept Liza Minnelli, and all of a sudden one day he said, no, he said, I don't think we're going to keep Nora Ferrari, which is the name I use now. And I write screenplays, and I write plays, and I've been in a movie, Reservation Row with Joaquin Phoenix. But anyway, so I went back to my old name. My real name is Nora Ferrari. Anyway, he didn't like it, and he said, you know, we got to give you a different name. I said, okay, what do you think? And he went through a whole list of names. He goes, I see you as a Tracy, but you have to spell it T-A-R-T-E-Y. I said, okay. And our last name, he said, how about Day? But not Day, D-A-Y, it has to be T-E-Y. Okay. So, of course, when people try to find me now, they can't because everybody spells it D-A-Y. Nobody even thinks of D-E-Y, but I'm Tracy Day, D-E-Y.
Well, Bob Cruise into numerology, too. So he found that there were certain, you know, spellings and things that would work well for certain people. Did you ever know that?
No, I didn't know that.
It was a very strange kind of thing about Bob, but he liked that kind of thing. So
I guess he was good at that because he did progress and make a lot of money.
That's true. So was he your producer most of the time?
Yes, he was my only producer. Bob Cruise was my producer, and he all those years.
I thought you were going to say you changed your name to Nora Oldsmobile or something like that, but I
not
think
quite.
No, it'd be better with Dodge or
Patience and Prudence. Yes, that was done in
that's earlier
yes.
than
the in the 1940s.
No, 1950s.
I'm much younger than
but
that.
But they though. Changed her the way her version was done. Yeah, they.
Yeah, we did it. That was the original, that one. And mine was made the charts, cash box, top 30. But we did a little bit, a great arrangement for that. And we kind of like made it more contemporary. And I did both charts with that. It was a little country and pop, too.
But weren't you competing with Peter Davis on that song?
Peter Davis, my luck. All of a sudden, Peter Davis decides to put the song out at the same time or whatever. Mine was out first, maybe by a week or two, that's it. And then all of a sudden, you hear Peter Davis with the same song, and I say, oh, no. But that's it. But I got a lot of air.
You got to travel a lot, though?
Oh, yeah. I went to all over the United States, the Caribbean, I love promoting the record, too, and you really need to disc jockeys all over the U.S. That was great. And, yeah, had a lot of fun stuff. Even Caracas, Venezuela, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. That was fun.
I'm lucky that I get to New Jersey, yeah.
Sure.
You know, lately I go to these different doo-wop shows, and there's one artist that's always there. It's, like, amazing. He was on Clay's show. I'm trying to remember what year this was now that this My True Story came out, but his name is Eugene Pitt. Yeah, a group called the Jive Five.
Thank you so very much.
Well, I can see there's a lot of people here that really know me. But I see Arthur and writers over there. You know, Arthur writers. He's on my back, too. Yeah, I've been on the road 50 years. And in my travel, I got a chance to meet a lot of people. I am the voice of Nickelodeon. I started Nickelodeon off. I got two Cleos. I wrote the top of the hour for Nickelodeon. And back in the younger years, I did a lot of shows for Mr. Clay Cole. Palisades Park. I couldn't wait for Sunday. See, what had happened, we would tell the guys in the group, don't eat. You're going to Palisades Park. Don't eat. And we go out there and we do our numbers, we sing and have a lot of fun, and then we go up to the restaurant where they set better big steaks and, you know, all the good food. So it was like a lot of fun. And coming up, like the lady said, we didn't make no money, but we had a lot of fun.
Backtracking it. You didn't make any money doing all these things?
Money?
What's that?
Money?
You must be from New Jersey.
Well, I don't know. Being that I was on a record label that sold 1.5 million records, I made $185. You can't call that money.
What label were you on?
Bell Tone.
Oh, is that Bobby Shad?
No.
Who's that? He won't.
Les Cahan.
Les Cahan? You didn't get paid very much.
No. Well, at the time, they had a little conflict with King's Records. Bert Keys, you know, they were going through a court thing. So I never knew what happened with the lawsuit because Bell Tone closed down and Eugene Pitt and the Jive Five went on to United Artists, where we put out Happy Man back in 65 that saved us during the British invasion. And it's thanks to you. You know, you were right behind us. You bought our music and kept us going.
Who wrote your songs, Eugene?
Well, I wrote the majority of the Jive Five songs.
And the hit Happy Man, was that yours too?
No, I wrote the other side, Kiss, Kiss, Kiss.
Who wrote
Happy Man? I wrote Happy Man along with Casey, but I gave him that side and I took the Kiss, Kiss, Kiss side.
And who's Casey?
He's one of the fellows in the group.
The other guy. Yeah.
And they put out Kiss, Kiss, Kiss down south. No, in New York. And they put out Happy Man down south. And we got a call back at the studio saying that Happy Man was taking off. So they said, well, flip it in New York. And during the British invasion, it brought us through.
Who were your producers when you first started and when you went to United Artists?
Okay, we had Otis Pollard. He was our producer, Otis Pollard. And then later on, I went to Honeybee Records, where I met Tony Bon Jovi. I gave him his job when he first came to New York. He was like the arranger for the Jive Five. Tony Bon Jovi, Les Case, not Tony Bon Jovi. Then we had Jay Ellis and Mico Minardo.
Mico Minardo did the Star Wars.
He did the Star Wars.
Yeah, if any of you remember the big disco hit Star Wars, that was Mico Minardo.
Mico Minardo.
Yeah, he was a trombone. He was a big on could play trombone. Could probably play any instrument.
Right.
He was known for playing that. And Billy Dominique Minardo.
Right. And I did most of the background work in the studio with Casey Spencer and myself. And I started Gloria Gaynor. I rehearsed her every day for 2 years. She came out with Never Could Say Goodbye, Honey Bee. And on the album, she and I are doing a song, We Belong Together, and Let's Make a Deal. And the record went overseas, turned platinum. So she became the disco queen.
Did you mostly record in New York?
Was it New York? Right?
Did you record in New York? Is that mostly?
Yeah, we recorded in New York.
The first time I ever heard your song, I don't remember if Alan Freed played it, but I was listening to the radio and I heard this song, and I said, wow, it blew my mind. It went something like this. Here is a gentleman, Richard Horahan, who is producing some of his stuff. And do you have the new CD that we can show? Brand new CD, just came out recently. I had the pleasure of being one of the first people to play it on my show not long ago. He's doing the old sound, the new sound, and you can thank Richard and him for getting together with this. This is available where today? It's some of the...
Room 412.
Oh, you're right next to
Yeah, right next to you, Mr. Cole.
Stepping out. And it's got some great stuff on here. And now you were on Clay's show also.
Oh, yes. Palisades Park.
You gave birth to him.
I'm telling you, well, he helped get me over.
Now we know why Clay disappeared for a few years.
Oh, that's why?
They were looking for him.
He ran away, huh? Okay. Now, one of the best guys you could ever work for. Believe me.
Were you at Palisades? That was like a secondary place.
That was like home. Every other Sunday, we were at Palisades Park. That's right.
There's nothing else ever been like that.
That's one place that should have never closed.
Freddie Cantor, remember he made that Palisades Park?
Yeah.
Well, a year before it closed, they asked him, the owner asked him to make another song called Ride Roller Coaster. I hope it would reassess. Mm-hmm. It didn't happen. But.
Yeah. You know what he told me about Clay? He said when Clay used to have artists come to the show, if they couldn't make it, they would call Freddie. Is that true?
Yes.
They would call Freddie and he'd be right there.
Well, Freddie was actually from Boston, but he was down in New York so much that we considered him one of our gang.
Right.
So he was part of our gang. The funny thing is, Palisades Park was our show was broadcast live 7 days a week from Palisades Park for an hour each day.
So 7 days a week?
Yeah, 7 days a week.
Got it.
And we had the free act stage show.
Yeah.
With that free act means you didn't get paid.
Well, that was promotion for the record, you know.
Well, they did. In return for the act appearing, Irving Rosenthal, the owner, hired these paper hangers, and in the middle of the night, they blanket the city with these huge posters announcing all the stars that are on the show. I was plastered all over town, literally. Anyway, households that never would watch rock and roll obviously knew me because my big picture was on every blank wall in New York City. But I just want to say that because of that 1 year, just a brief period in my life, that one summer, anytime anyone ever stops me on the street or wants to reminisce, the first thing they say is, Palisades Park.
That's right.
For some reason, that show and that combination made an impact.
And the second thing they ask is, do you have any of those shows left in your collection?
Well, I don't. You know, Channel 11 erased or recorded over all the tapes. But when we were doing Channel 13 at Palisades Park, we were live every day in black and white. And Chubby Checker came on.
Oh,
he had a song called, I think it was Round and Round, which our producer liked because everything in the park goes round and round.
Yeah.
You know, he says, but Chubby, we need two songs from you, you know, for an hour show. So what was on the flip side? It's a song I called The Twist, he said. I said, well, okay, you'll do The Twist. Now, Chubby later confided in me. He had no idea how to do The Twist. He'd never seen Hank Ballard do it. So he just made up the movement to do The Twist. And The Twist was performed for the first time ever and sung first time ever by Chubby Checker on that Palisades Park show. Of course, you know what happened after that. This huge explosion worldwide of The Twist, the Peppermint Twist, and Chubby's record went on the charts number one twice. I think it's the only.
Yeah,
you're the second.
Well, not only that, but one of the most fun things that I remember about The Twist and Chubby Checker is coming home from school at about strange time, I think 4:15 in the afternoon, you would learn how to do The Twist with Chubby Checker. I believe on Channel
W-O-R.
7. Yeah, was it WOR? Yeah, and it was black and white, of course, or at least my little TV was black and white, and I remember tuning in and he said, you know, it's like putting out a cigarette, you know, and you're telling the kids that too, you know, but it's true, and he's going like that, just keep squishing out the cigarette, and that's how you get to do The Twist. And this was like every day, it was an unheard of thing, learning how to do a dance every day. It might have been like right before American Bandstand.
Yeah.
You know, that's what I'm thinking. Maybe it's like 5 minutes a day, 5 of 4. I think a bandstand went on at 4, I think, 4 to 5. That's how it was.
And not only that, he had a thing that you buy these Tom McCann shoes and you could twist.
Right. What a tie-in.
5 pairs and couldn't twist nothing. Tom McCann shoes.
You know, we don't want to leave out, these are great stories and everything, but we don't want to leave out our last person on the panel here, who is truly one of the greats in the music business. I had the fortune of meeting him about a month or two ago. Was it Ray Clausen? Ray Clausen's party. He was having a party. strangely enough, I won't even tell you that part of the story, but I'm going to play you something. See if you all recognize this work by our next guest, because I think you all should recognize this. Here we go. Check this out. He wrote this. Who knows what it is? Hundreds of credits, television theme songs and Broadway shows and movie soundtracks and everything. His name is Billy Goldenberg, right over there. Billy Goldenberg. So, as long as you play Kojak, I do have to tell you a story.
Tell us about Kojak.
By the way, that was not the original.
No, that's the only one I could find, but it's Willie Bobo, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Actually, we did the original with the Universal Studios Fab Orchestra. And so, anyway, I had done a movie for television, which was Marcus Nelson Murders. And
that was a great film. Marcus Nelson Murders, Kelly Savalas.
That's right. And so, anyway, Abby Mann had written that and wanted me to do the music. So we were a big hit. And then Universal Studios decided to use that as a pilot for a series called Kojak. And so Abby came to me and said, well, you should write the theme to Kojak. And I'd really never done a television show theme before. So that was my first. And so anyway, we did the theme, and the show was an instant hit. The show did really, really well. And all of a sudden, you know, my relatives all over the world, they finally realized that I wasn't a bum. I mean, if you were a musician, you were a bum. There's no question about it. But now, at least, they saw the name Goldenberg on television, so they treated me a little bit better. But anyway, we did the Kojak each year because of Musicians Union rules. You had to re-record the television themes when the season began. So I had written the original arrangements, and it was very easy. Every year I would come in and conduct the orchestra, and we would play the same arrangement. And this went on for a few years. Then the head of the music department came to me and he said, Hillary wants to see you. I said, Kelly Savalas, who I've not met. And he said, yeah, we'd like to see you in his trailer. So I went over to the trailer, and there's Kelly Savalas with his brother, and they had the television on, and there was some kind of war going on in Cyprus, and they were watching that very intently, and with a lot of Greek food around, and I love to eat. So the first thing he did was, Kelly said, Billy boy, I want you to have some Gomadis and some German Salada and, you know, shish kebab, all the kinds of stuff I love. So I ate very well in the trailer. Then he put his arm around me so I knew I probably was in trouble. And he said, you know, I'm the star of this program and I'm Greek. And I just don't feel the music has any Greek feel to it.
I said, I know I'm Jewish, actually. So I guess, you know, it might be that. And he said, well, I know you have to re-record it, but could you kind of add some Greek stuff in it? I mean, some balalaikas. Yeah, I don't know. This particular theme was really didn't suit itself to Greek music. Anyway, I said, I'll do what I can, Kelly. And he said, okay, I'm going to be there at the recording session. So the head of the music department, Harry Garfield, was very, very nervous about it. He said, you better do something because, you know, we want to keep the theme and we've got to make Kelly happy and all of those things. I said, I'll see what I can do. So you have to know, I worked so much at Universal Studios that all the musicians were my friends. I've been really, really good friends. And they never would let anything bad happen to me. And they saved my ass so many times, I cannot thank them. But I will never, never say a word against musicians because, I mean, they're the real stars, and they're the ones that make my music sound good. So, anyway, I wrote an arrangement for Kojak for that season, which was, it was kind of a combination of Never on Sunday and and Ben Hur's March into Rome. I mean, I knew that, you know, Kelly wanted something really kind of, you know, majestic and thrilling, you know, because of his wonderful personality and demeanor and all of that. So anyway, I explained to the guys in the orchestra, I said, Mr. Sabalas is going to come in and I'm doing this new arrangement, so, you know, just really play your hearts out. So we rehearsed things. And then after a couple of rehearsals, Kelly walked in with his entire entourage. It was Kelly, it was all the executives at Universal, the executives at the music department, Kelly's family. I mean, it just went on and on. And so I brought him up to the podium. I said, gentlemen, this is Kelly Savalas. And they all screamed and yelled and said, yo, Kelly, we love you, we love you, you know. Wait until you hear this music, you know, it's fantastic. And he said, thanks, guys. I didn't realize that this kind of fan club. And he said, you know, all of them were screaming and yelling. And so I went into this thing, and they really played their hearts out. And so I said, well, so I went, I said, it's okay. And he said, could I stand on the podium with you? I said, sure. You know, so he came on that podium. The musician said, yo, Terry, we love you, we love you. And so we played it again. And each time it got stronger and stronger, you know. I said, more balalaikas, you know, and more trumpets for the Roman part, you know. And so anyway, we finished it and we recorded it. And Terry said, you know, this is exactly what I wanted. It's really, really me. He said, I can't tell you how thrilled I am. It's got that Greek feel, and it's got that, you know, really majestic feel. And it's me. You know, I said, I know. I said, and all the musicians applauded when he walked down, you know. And so he walked out with all of these Universal executives. Everybody was smiling. And so they all walked out, and the entire orchestra broke down. They broke into huge laughter because they knew exactly what we had done. I said, I could never thank you enough for this. You have no idea. So that was one thing about the Kojak. And the other, after the first year of doing Kojak, it was the most popular show all over the world. And it went into syndication in different countries. And anyway, I was going to make my first trip to Europe. So I got a travel agent after a year of Kojak. And I said, I want to go to Paris. I want to go to London. We all have the places. And so she checked. She said, there are no hotels available in London. I said, oh, well, what do we do? He said, well, you know, I represent a lot of Hollywood people. Is there any kind of piece of music that you have done recently that they might know? I said, I think possibly. I said, the team project. She said, that's all I need. So she called up some hotel in London, which turned out to be an absolutely wonderful hotel, and said, the writer of the music, the project, is coming. Do you have a room? Well, of course we have a room. There is no problem at all. So I went there. There was much fans. They could not do enough for me, I said. So, I mean, I was happy about that, you know. It probably was the best thing ever. And I had a great European vacation. And years later, I did Columbo, and that helped me get hotel rooms everywhere. especially in Japan, as a matter of fact, where a very good friend of mine lives with his family, and he took me to one of the local restaurants, and there were all these Japanese businessmen sitting around the table at the counter, and we were having sushi, and wonderful. And they all wanted to know who I was. So Haji and my friend went over and explained. Well, they got really excited. But suddenly, one of my Japanese men came over to me and started giving me their card. And I said, well, thank you very much. I said, but why do you do this? He said, Mr. Goldenberg-san, you write Columbo. And I said, well, thank you very much. That is our favorite show. And I kind of enjoyed it because I watched it in Japanese, you know. And there was a certain amount that was lost. But,
hey, Billy,
but it was wonderful.
One of the greatest things you've ever done was you had the opportunity to work with Steven Spielberg, right? The very first film he ever did, correct? The movie is one of my all-time favorites. It's called Duel. Do any of you know that film?
Well, I have a clip for you.
So do you want me to show a clip?
Okay.
This is a clip of Duel. Now, in case you don't know what it is, I'll just set it up really quickly. Duel is Dennis Weaver driving a car. He's a salesman, traveling salesman, correct? And behind him is the most menacing truck. You never see the driver's face. But this guy who's driving the truck is out to get Dennis Weaver throughout the 90-minute movie, which was a brilliant film and great music by you because it was all special kinds of music. So I'm going to show you a little bit of a clip of this. If this doesn't scare the hell out of you and make you go buy the DVD, I don't know what will. But this is it.
Did he go to? Do I have time for a story?
Yes, tell it. That's one of the great movies.
Okay. Steven Spielberg was 21 years old, and this was his first full-length film. He did do, before this, he did an episode of Night Gallery, which I did the music for, and that was the first time I met Steven. And he was so creative.
I don't know if this is true or not. Maybe you could tell me this, but from what I understand, Steven Spielberg was not hired in any way by Universal in the beginning. He just simply walked into the lot and took up residence in an office. It had a phone in it, and he just became part of the... He'd say hello to the guards, and he just took over and took an office, and he was not hired by anybody.
Now I'm going to tell you the real story.
Okay.
Okay. Spielberg had made a short film called Amblin. You might notice...
That's his production.
That's his production company called Amblin Entertainment. And this was a short black and white film that he had made, and he lived not too far from the Universal Studios. He made the film like for about $2,000, got all of his friends to contribute to it and so forth. Anyway, Universal Studios had very, very high security. So it was Steven's desire to get this film to Universal Studios somehow, and he had no contacts there. So anyway, he climbed over the fence. It was a link fence. He climbed over the fence and he snuck into the executive tower building there and went up to the top floor, and he just went into one of the offices, and there was a guy there who was the lawyer for Universal Studios. His name was Sidney Sheinberg. And Sidney said, "Who are you?" He said, "Well, I have this film that I want you to look at." He said, "Well, how did you get in here?" He said, "I climbed over the fence, you know." And Sidney was so taken with that. He said, "Well, it takes a lot of guts, you know. Plus, you're Jewish like me, you know, so I understand, you know, what that, you know, entails. You got a lot of guts, kid. You know, how old are you?" He said, 21 years old. He said, "Okay." So he ran the film, and he loved the film. So he showed it to Lou Wasserman, who was the head of the studio. He went crazy for it, and they did sign him, actually.
Has that film ever been seen?
I don't know if they ever showed it in any of the theaters. I don't think so.
And you didn't do the music for it?
I didn't do the music for it. I didn't know when he first did it. But the end of this story was quite nice. Sidney gave him the break. Well, at first, Stephen got an office in Universal Studios, and then they started giving him television shows to do. So the first one was Night Gallery with Joan Crawford. The second one he did, I did with him too, was the very first episode of Columbo with Jack Cassidy. And then he did Duel after that. But anyway, I'm going to skip a lot of years. Universal Studios was sold to Matsu Visa. They were the parent, they are the parent company of Panasonic. And when they were sold to Matsuhisa, the executives, the new owners from Japan, came over and wanted to replace a lot of the executives at Universal. And Sid was on the chopping block. So by that time, Steven had done several films for Universal. He had done Jaws, he had done E.T., The Extraterrestrial, Off the Lot, he had done Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Raiders of the Lost Ark. He was the number one director in Hollywood. And you know, Mr. Sheinberg gave him his first break. So anyway, when he Susan went over to the Scheinbergs' house one night for dinner, and Sid was very unhappy. And Susan said, "What's going on?" He said, "Well, I'm about to get canned." She said, "What do you mean you're about to get canned?" And he said, "Well, the new owners of the studio, they mean the Matsushita people?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "They want to put in all their own executives." And so Stephen said, "Well, that's not going to happen, Sid, because if you leave, I leave."
Wow.
And by that time, Stephen had quite a compound, which he still has, at Universal Studios that they built especially for him. So Stephen went to the executives and said, "I'm sorry, I'm going to leave. If Mr. Scheinberg leaves, and also several of the other executives who have been so helpful to me, and I feel comfortable here. I wouldn't just feel comfortable with you guys. So if that's what you want, I'm going to form a new company," which he finally did, by the way, DreamWorks, later on. But he saved Sid's job.
Wow. So, did you say that there was a story connected to Duel, or...
I know this is living in time, so I don't want to...
Okay.
Well, we had exactly 2 weeks to do Duel. The entire film had to be shot, edited, and scored, and dubbed in 2 weeks. A film that would generally take several months to do. No, it had to be done in 2 weeks because it was optioned by ABC, from Universal, and ABC's numbers were way, way down. They needed something strong to boost their numbers, and we were coming to sweep week, so they said, "We've got to have this film." They lost the film, and they said, "We've got to have this in 2 weeks." So Stephen came to me and he said, "We're going to do this thing. So I want you to come to all of the shooting of the show so you can get a feel of what the music should be." And I said, "Okay, I'm going to have to start writing music right away." And he said, "I know. Everybody's starting with music. I mean, what they would do is they would shoot a scene, ship it off to 12 film editors, each of whom had a part of the film to do." Now, I was the only composer on the show, so I was terrified. I didn't know how it looked, but I started writing music right away. He said, "I think you should get a feel of this menacing truck. So I want you to ride in the passenger seat of this truck." Now, in this film, you never saw the face of the truck driver, because the truck was a metaphor for a dinosaur. Of course, speaking to Jurassic Park afterwards, but this was the first real dinosaur film that he did, except it was a truck. And so we shot the thing in the Mojave Desert, which was very, very hilly, and there were several scenes where the truck had to go down a very, very steep hill very quickly, and, you know, there were turns, and it's a very dangerous thing. But they had, as the driver, Harry Lofton, who was the number one stunt driver in New York. He did all the famous stuff for,
Gene Hackman's movie,
which was...
Bullet?
That's right. He did Bullock, and then the one, I'm not going to call it, I'll think of it later. But anyway, so Stephen had clouded up the passenger seat window, so you couldn't see who was sitting in the passenger seat, because it would be pretty ridiculous in this movie, you know, to see a middle class composer from Queens sitting in the passenger seat. Meanwhile, Harry Lofton, who was this crazy man, and had a little bit too much to drink too, and his His face was absolutely deep red. So he's driving like a wild man. And every time we would go past the camera, Harry would push me down, you know, so that there was no way that they would see my face. And so I would be cowering in the seat. And then I got, you know, so every day I was in that truck. And then afterwards, somehow we did it. I wrote the music very quickly, created a lot of loops. So you were getting a lot of music in there that reduced itself, which I generally would not do, but it was the only thing I could do because it was almost nonstop music and sound. Very little dialogue in the movie. So anyway, the movie went on in 1971. And in 1971, I had to have a stomach operation as a result of an ulcer operation I had. They had to remove some scar tissue. So anyway, I went to the hospital right after I bought the movie. So anyway, they did the operation, and I'm taking quite a lot of pain to them, but they were reducing the pain to them little by little. And all the nurses came in and they said, "We understand you have a show on tonight." I said, "Yes, but I would really prefer if you didn't show up." And I said, "Well, it's this new director, Steven Spielberg, in it. We understand it's very exciting. There's a lot of press about it, a lot of truck." I said, "Yes, it's very loud. And I frankly don't mind. I'm a little pained." So this thing went on, and they were playing it full, and I'm in terrible pain. The more the film goes on, the worse pain I'm in. You know, I said, "Please, could you give me a Demerol or something to put me to sleep or play some soft music, something? I hate this music." And but no, they had to play it all 2 hours, and I was a wreck at the end of it. I said, "Thank you very much, and we all congratulated you. What the..." So,
ladies and gentlemen,
the problem.
Billy Goldenberg. Billy Goldenberg.
Sue, you got something to say? Actually, I got 3 things to say. I wanted to ask Tracy if you had this to do over again. Is there anything you would do differently or not do? Think about your career now.
Yes, I think I would have gotten a manager. Believe it or not, I didn't have a manager at that time. I just was assigned to the record label. And I really think that was my big mistake, because I think a manager would be somebody that would really, like, look out for you, push you, and probably got another recording contract, whatever, going. But I was kind of naive and young, and that's my mistake.
Did your singing career actually end back in the 60s? I mean, you're into other things now.
Yes, it ended after Bob Crew, and then I went on to college. I got a master's from Columbia University, because I had an undergraduate degree from Fordham University before that. Then I got my master's in theater arts at Columbia, and got married, had 2 wonderful sons. I had 2 wonderful sons, and my life took a different turn at that time, and then back into show business again. Now I'm writing. I'm a playwright with the H.P. Herbert Berghoff Theater down in Greenwich Village, and I also do